that Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, and they just disagree on how.
We're going to get across that wasteland, and we're going to do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future
for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/greenimpact.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast, the Edinburgh podcast that gives you the news, views and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, all with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter, we are at Mall Over Podcast, Mall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook, and we are now a part of the Sports Podcast Network, a network of sports podcasts, and surprisingly, of all sorts of genres and sports and all sorts of different stuff for your perusal, so make sure you go check that out. This week, I'm joined by the handsome farm vet. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, He's dropped
the hello, ladies. And
it's just hello now.
Just hello now. And Ben, you may have heard Ben just having a quick cough in the background. Yeah. You right there, mate?
Yeah, just choking to death in my own time.
Yeah, just don't disturb the podcast, all right? Mm. Cool. So there's loads of stuff to get through tonight. I wanted to start off on a slightly somber note. And I know we had rugby against cancer. We did our rugby against cancer charity match in October, and we managed to raise quite a considerable amount of money. And the reason we do that is to help people and the rugby community support families and support people who have been diagnosed with cancer, who are involved in the rugby community. And unfortunately, over the weekend, a close friend of mine, who I played in a beach rugby tournament with in the summer of last year, perfectly, you know, at the time, seemingly perfectly healthy and happy in August last year, unfortunately, lost his battle with bowel cancer over the weekend. And he was a big figurehead for Western Hornets, Phil Hogarth, a real stalwart of a club, a clubman for Western Supermare Hornets. And it'll be greatly missed. I know the outpouring of support throughout the rugby community locally and around the Western area. But it just goes to show that in a very short space of time, somebody who appears very healthy can deteriorate quite rapidly. So a bit of a sad weekend, but the rugby fraternity all clubbed in, and they've already raised lots of money in support for Phil's family and through Western Hornets. I know that they're gonna be streaming his service on the 25th of February at the Hornets clubhouse. So anybody that is local and listens to this, make sure you get along there, support, have a drink and raise a glass to Hollywood Phil Hogarth, who was an absolute legend. So sorry to start off on a bit of a downer, but I wanted to recognise him because he was an absolute legend and made me really sad at the weekend. So there you go. Rest in peace, Phil. Go well, mate. Yeah, I don't really know what to follow that with.
I don't think you really need to follow it with anything much, Russ. I think we've all been in a situation where we've had people who've been either close to us or just kind of strong acquaintances that have been hit by things that have taken them far too soon, and it's never nice. And I suppose that's one of the strong points of rugby, is that everybody will come together as a community and do what they can for friends and family.
And I'll tell you what, I'll move on with something actually that's just popped into my head. That last week, I don't know if you remember, Ben, that I mentioned a guy who I'd met at a works conference called Alex Bull. I said, I need to issue a correction here. I said that Alex played for Old Reds. Now, Alex didn't play for Old Reds. He actually played for Cleve, which he swiftly told me later in the week. But not before friend of the pod, George Ferris, had messaged me to say that Alex Bull from Cleve, he was the one that smashed my shoulder up when I played for Dings with a late hit. So then straight away we had this strange connection, because Alex had told me this story about when he got married in Cornwall and he was on the piss in Newquay the day after his wedding, basically leaving his wife and family to do whatever, and he went on the smash. He was actually on the piss with George, which it's a small world, isn't it? Anyway, the rugby community. And then as it transpires, I was in Bristol on Saturday watching the rugby with a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, we got chatting, and Ben Roberts is his name. He listens to the podcast as well. He said, "Oh, I used to play rugby for Cleve." I said, "Oh, do you know Alex Bull?" He went, "Oh yeah, yeah, he's one of my best mates." So the circle was very much complete at that point, where I'd met Alex in Exeter, who had then been on the piss with George in Newquay, who was also very good friends with a mate of mine who lives in Bristol. And I had no idea about any of this, but the correction is obviously Alex played for Cleve and not Old Reds. He was very unhappy about me saying that he played for Old Reds, which is hardly surprising.
Well, nobody in their right mind would own up to playing for Old Reds.
That's true. But if you do play for Old Reds and you are listening, then, you know, well done, because you are a great bunch of guys. please don't find me. Right. I mean, I've talked a lot in the opening period of this podcast. And before we get on to the Six Nations stuff.
Yeah. If you're going to list everybody, you know, it might take a while.
I'm kind of a big deal, Ben. Before we get into England, Scotland, I've came across something today and it was brought to my attention on Twitter. There is an account called the Rayburn Shield. I don't know if you have ever heard of this. It's basically a linear title for the best team, but a team who has beaten the team that holds it before. Almost like the heavyweight title, the champion of the world, I guess. So a team up until this Saturday, England were the holders of the Rayburn Shield, having beaten South Africa in the autumn. But I caught up with David Algie, who was you kind of come up with this concept right from the very start of international rugby in 1871. He's tracked it all the way through to today, and he's coming up with some great ideas. So I caught up with him a little while ago, who told me all about it. So, as mentioned, I'm here with David, who is probably better known to most of you on Twitter, if you haven't already discovered him, as at Rayburn Shield. Welcome to Mall Over, David. How are you?
Ah, thank you. Welcome. I'm pleased to be here. Honoured that you invited me along.
Oh, I mean, we don't have many guests. I mean, that's not usually by design. I mean, not many people just want to come on. But, you know, it's a pleasure to have you. And since you you reached out to us on Twitter earlier about mentioning the Rayburn Shield, I thought, well, what better than me trying to explain it to people? Why not talk to you about it, and you can explain the premise and how you've come up with it? But I guess it's something that's been ongoing for a number of years, and you're taking on the mantle to highlight it.
Yeah, well, it's a funny one actually. In some ways, we came up with it, as in it didn't exist at all. but we recognise what it was. Let me start with what it is. So, like, the first international rugby match was in 1871 between England and Scotland, played at Raeburn Place in Edinburgh, and Scotland won. And if you just imagine that they're like your boxing title holder, like they're the world champ. So whoever beats them takes the title off them. And so the following year, in 1872, they played England. England won that time, and they took the Raeburn Shield, if it had have existed. And then, you know, so on, it's changed hands over time. And whoever holds it just has to defend it. It's really hard to do. Would have changed hands like 207 times now. You know, and some teams have held it for a long time. The great All Blacks team of the late 1980s held it for 17 matches in a row, which is the record. But some have held it for one. So Scotland held it for one game in last November before losing it to England. Before losing it to the Springboks, who lost it to England. And England on the weekend just lost to Scotland. So Scotland have got it back again. They are currently the Raeburn Shield holders.
Amazing. And the goal, I guess, is to get world rugby to kind of recognise the Raeburn Shield as a legitimate thing, as an actual competition, I guess.
Yeah. So in the long term, I think we will get world rugby to recognise it. I'll be honest, they're sort of irrelevant at the moment because really it's about the fans, right? Like, rugby's more fun when all nations are competing for the same prize. So it's way more fun when that four-year period, you're all competing for the same prize. And this fills that gap. And there's no reason why we can't enjoy it. Because although it's not officially recognised, what it tracks is very real. And so we do keep track of it. And, of course, it's the same in the women's game. So the first women's game was in 1982, which is much more recent, between France and the Netherlands and Utrecht. So the Utrecht Shield is the women's equivalent. And England actually hold that at the moment, though, and I can't see anyone taking it off them. That Red Roses side is spectacular.
Yeah, well, not for a little while anyway. Not until, I mean, there's a Women's World Cup.
Yeah, there is, but no one's probably beaten them at that either. They're
and they are good, aren't they?
They're special gravy.
So, you know, you mentioned New Zealand, they had a 17-match winning streak.
Yeah.
What are the sort of interesting facts are there about the Raeburn, like the most obscure countries that may have held the Raeburn Shield?
So Romania held it in the mid-1980s for one match, which is surprising. I mean, I would have never picked them to hold a world title of any kind. Argentina have held it. Japan actually have held it a couple of times in recent years. And they also have not only held it but defended it. So that's the thing, right? Like, it's exciting to win it, but holding on to it for any length of time is really hard to do. And so Japan have managed three matches in a row, which is, you know, that's ultimately the challenge, is first off to become a Raeburn Shield holder. And there's a few nations who have done that, you know, the ones you'd expect: England, Scotland, South Africa, Australia. But it's a matter of defending it. And so Samoa, for instance, won it in 1999. They won it during that Rugby World Cup. And that big shock that they had actually was a Raeburn Shield match, it turns out. and they would have been holders had it been recognised.
Yeah. You know?
And so there's all these extra threads of interest that come through. And what I loved was in the autumn, in November, when England and South Africa were playing, the Raeburn Shield was on the line. And I had a few Scotsmen online on Twitter saying, I really, really want England to win this because they knew they'd get the first.
Because they could take it. Yeah, they could take it straight back from us.
Exactly. And that's the beauty, right, is that it gives you that investment. And so I produce sometimes a thing that shows you where the Shield might go in the next few matches. Yeah. And so, like, you know, in the Six Nations, anyone could probably get to it, you know, because actually Wales are going to get a chance to challenge for it now. But then after that, if Scotland manage to keep it, France get the next challenge. And then after that, it's Italy and then Ireland. But of course, if Wales beat them up front, then I think Wales play England after that. So it could go. So there's like this mental chess game of who in the earth is going to get a challenge. And if you're a Southern Hemisphere fan, and I'm a Kiwi, I actually live in Twickenham, but I'm a Kiwi boy. And, you know, you're looking at it going, well, who can take it away on a summer tour? So actually, I wouldn't mind Ireland getting hold of it because they're coming to New Zealand in June. You know, and actually, the All Blacks haven't held it since 2017. You know, haven't even had a shot since 2018.
A lot of it, I guess, then comes back to circumstances, doesn't it? Because if there's no fixture scheduled against the title holder, against the champ, then you're not going to get a shot. Like,
yeah, it's just dumb luck.
Yeah, because like you say, Scotland go to Wales on Saturday.
Yeah,
and if Wales win, then France aren't going to get a shot potentially until. They play Wales. Well, But they might get a shot if they play Wales. They're going to play Wales in the Six Nations. But if it's not straight away, I mean, I can't remember what the fixtures look like, but if they're not playing Wales straight away, then it could go to somebody else.
Yeah.
So the France miss out completely.
And so, like, you think about it, like, so the All Blacks are a really good example at the moment. They haven't even had a shot since 2018. And you imagine you're an All Blacks player, you win all sorts of things. That's great. But if this was really acknowledged and known about, when you finally got your shot at the Rayburn Shield, you might only have 2 years in the jersey. When they finally get a shot at it, it's a big moment, right? Because you either take it or you don't. And as it comes through, and I think New Zealanders are quite familiar with it because we have something in our provincial game called the Ranfurly Shield, and it's very similar. It's just the only defender at home. So Kiwis often get this immediately because they know that vibe. The Ranfurly Shield is huge. Teams like grow an extra leg and eat red meat all week to make sure they're well up for it. You know, like it's a serious thing. And so this could have that same vibe in international rugby. And I think once people, you know, kind of get into it and join all the dots and go, oh, I get what this is, it becomes this like exciting thread through the game, you know?
Yeah. And is there anywhere, like, is there a website or is there, have you got stuff that people can go and visit to look at the history?
Do you know, the biggest thing is that I am trying to build momentum with the fans. So anyone who can follow or support us on social media, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. Heck, I joined TikTok because they they've got the Women's Six Nations now, and we don't have real shields. I've got a like Fomex version of the Utrecht shield here, cool. And I took that, made that, and took it to one of the Red Roses games in November, and I got them to sign it. So it's pretty cool. I've got a load of pictures of the Red Roses holding a replica. What I'm actually about to do is make a real shield. You know, so I've bought myself some more kit. I'm going to make, for instance, the Rayburn shield be made out of Scottish oak in honour of the first holders, Scotland, and the Utrecht shield will be made out of French oak in honour of the first holders, France. You know, and then we'll inscribe on it. And I think in order to help fund all that, I'll give people the chance to pay to have their name inscribed on the back of those shields so you can be a part of rugby history. But that's all to come. You know, that's all to come. And I think over time, and I've been doing this since 2008, there was a bunch of us on a rugby forum who are a bit sad about the All Blacks losing a Rugby World Cup again. They're going, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way to track success.
The lineal champs.
We're like, there's got to be a better way. We've got to, you know. And so we all thought it was fun. But me being me, I was like, actually, this is good. This needs to exist. Yeah. And so I've been running it ever since.
I can't believe it's the first time I've kind of heard of it, and it is absolutely exceptional. I absolutely love the premise. Yeah. I love the idea of it. It's so simple to understand. Even when we first started speaking before I started recording, I said like, I still don't kind of understand it. And then you explained it to me, and I was like, ah, yeah, actually, it's exactly like that.
Yeah.
And to know how quickly it can change hands, if you're aware of the fixtures, if you're aware of where the Rayburn Shield sits,
you can really
invest in it. And I think, you know, especially throughout the Six Nations, for the Scottish fans, and it's a real opportunity to gain some traction for you as well, which is the more people can get involved.
It makes a huge difference actually when there's games on. So like during the pandemic, it was hard because there was no games. And South Africa didn't play during 2020. They stepped out of everything. So it was tricky, but it's really nice having them back again now. You know, and there's different things for different nations, right? So like South Africa, they've held it for the longest if you take it by days, because they held it through World War II. And there wasn't many games being played at that point. You know, so they held it through, I think, from like 1939 till 1953. Yeah. Insane, I mean, a period of time, but, you know, for good reason. And then you've got all these different records that kind of can come through. First holders were Scotland, obviously, England after that, and then, you know, kind of Wales and Ireland played in. I think the box first held in about 1907, and the All Blacks actually never held it until like 1923 was the first time. So there's like this rich history that exists if we choose to recognise it.
Yeah.
And so that's the nice thing. What I also really love is that I'm a big fan of the women's game. Huge fan. You know, it's rugby, right? It's all rugby. And I enjoy it. And so I love the fact that the Utrecht Shield and the Rayburn Shield can kind of stand side by side. And it's like that shared experience through both of our games. And I'm really excited. And actually, this year is 40 years of international women's rugby. in June. So in June it'll be 40 years. And so I'm hoping to have the shield for the Utrecht Shield built first and ready for June so that we can do some cool things around that 40 year anniversary.
That's amazing. I mean, it sounds incredible. And if people can throw their support behind it, even like I say, just by following and sharing and retweeting and all of that sort of stuff. On Twitter, you are at Rayburn Shield.
Yeah, we'll keep it real simple. At Rayburn Shield and at Utrecht Shield. And we're that everywhere. So fortunately, they're not common terms. So I've been able to secure them all.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll retweet and we'll share all of the stuff as well. And, you know, if people, is there a website or anything, or can you get through through social media?
No, I've got rayburnshield.com and Utrecht Shield. I've got both of them. So yeah, anything where people can come through. We're even on Wikipedia. So it's almost like we're real.
Yeah. you absolutely are real. And it's an amazing thing. And the fact that it now belongs to Scotland, hurts me deep.
It's funny, isn't it? Something you never knew about, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, that sucks. We've lost that.
It's just a tip off to another disappointing weekend for English rugby.
It's not nearly as disappointing as me. I'm a New Zealander, and my 7-year-old tells me he wants to wear an England shirt. You don't know true disappointment till you hear that.
But then, though, I suppose living in Twickenham in the shadow of the stadium is probably all he's ever known.
Yeah, what are you going to do? You know, like he's like, Dad, I'm born here. I'm like, I know. Great regrets and all that, mate.
Never mind. Listen, David, it has been absolutely brilliant to meet you. Best of luck with everything. We will, like I say, we will share everything. We will get behind it. If there's anything we can do, maybe we'll get on something in the summer. And we'll talk to you again with regards to the Utrecht Shield and find out how you're getting on and how you're getting on with the making of the shields.
That's amazing. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me along. And anyone who enjoys the concept, your support's appreciated, because this is about the fans, the players. It's about us enjoying it. Maybe World Rugby recognise it in the future. Who cares about them? It's about us enjoying the game.
Yeah. And it absolutely is a fan thing. And from the minute that I started looking at it earlier on this afternoon, I was like, my God, this is amazing. So let's all get behind it. Thank you very much, David. And we will speak to you pretty soon.
Right. Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Bye-bye. I mean, that's pretty cool. I love the idea of it. I hate the idea of the fact that Scotland have taken it off of us this weekend. I mean, I didn't know it existed until today, but it was like another little dagger through the heart.
Now you wish you'd never known it existed.
true.
I quite like the kind of the regressive playground approach of winner stays on, as it were. And I suppose it gives teams, or it might give teams a bit of something else, a bit of bragging rights, and it probably makes more sense than the World Rugby rankings do. So
I mean, anything can make more sense than the World Rugby rankings, couldn't they? So who knows? Still, it's a bit of fun, and hopefully good on them
for doing it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. Well, now it's time for us to talk about England, Scotland.
Can we talk about the other match first?
You want to talk about Ireland Wales first, do you?
Well, I'd love to.
Okay, then let's do that.
Primarily because I was super impressed with Ireland and Wales was super shit. And one of those things gives me pleasure, and it's not the Irish one. But, no, Ireland were like really good, really well. You could see, and actually there are some analogies with the England-Scotland game, but you could see that they had a fairly well-defined game plan, like they always have done, and they delivered exactly to that game plan. There was a lot of Ringrose at first receiver, giving Sexton a bit more time to see what was in front of him. There was some really good play around the tight, and they weren't afraid to earn the right to go wide, and then when they went wide, they looked fantastic with the ball. I think whatever Farrell's doing over there, it's working
well.
It's
interesting, isn't it? Because for the last 2 years, Ireland have seemed not necessarily rudderless, but they've been going through that transition, that post-Schmidt transition, where Farrell stepped in and it was a bit of a struggle for them to find a new identity. And they were in a bit of a transitional period. But even with the old, you know, the old guard of Sexton, you know, with Aki, the likes of Furlong and Burn, you know, they're starting to develop a real sense of identity again. And I really enjoy the back row. That back row of Van der Flier and, oh God,
Doris.
That's it. It's Doris. The name has escaped me. And Jack Conan is exciting. It's moved away from the, you know, for all the good work Peter Omani has done for Ireland over the years and the irritant that he is, that is a dynamic, exciting, ball-carrying back row that's going to give you go forward.
Yeah.
They all carry, don't they?
The Omani, Ferris or O'Brien and the South African chap, CJ.
Stander, Ferris and O'Brien. That was the last exciting one they had, wasn't it?
It was a lot of physicality there, but they weren't as mobile and they weren't as perhaps exciting. But I think you're right, Russ, that Farrell's not come in and tried to kind of copy Schmidt or be an extension of Schmidt. He's come in and tried to do his own thing, which is why it's taken a bit of time for them to almost get their heads around it. And I think this is the thing that we forget a bit with international rugby, that they're not with their coaches week in, week out. They get limited amount of face time. And you've always got that background of them being told different things at a club level. So a big change is always going to take a bit of time. But yeah, just the whole... So Gary Ringrose is a fantastic player. Using him really effectively as a decoy, as first receiver, I think was a masterstroke, really.
They've struggled to get... I know he's had a little bit of injury problem, but one thing I've noted in Farrell's tenure is that they've struggled to almost get Ringrose on the pitch, or they haven't gone with Ringrose on the pitch. It's been a lot of Aki and Henshaw, and Ringrose hasn't really got a look in. And now he did. And on Saturday, he, like you say, he looked, you know, every inch the established international centre, didn't he?
But they were, I think what they were trying to do is keep as few people in the sort of breakdown as they could, which gave them more runners. And then they kind of identified what was the stress point in the Welsh defence, which was Adams at 13, being, you know, hung out to dry, really, playing out of position. And they just overloaded him with options. He had four people to pick who to tackle. Many times. And they kind of, you know, all right, they identified that as a weakness. But, you know, you've got a guy playing out of position, and I think we'll probably touch on this with the England game as well. But in Ringrose, you've got a guy who's an out and out outside centre.
Yeah.
You probably couldn't really play him anywhere else.
I am. Carry on, Ben.
But he's got that outside break that, you know, a classic centre would have, which came into play several times. And I think, you know, all of that Ireland side played well. I mean, the winger that scored the two tries, is it Conway? I mean, I thought he was really good. Both props were fantastic. I mean, Porter was an absolute menace. I mean, I think just showed what a miss he was for the Lions. And as you say, that back row really played well. But like Sexton, it was like it'd taken 10 years off him.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is as much as Ringrose is an out-and-out outside centre, with the ball, he was standing at 10 quite a lot. But when he was standing at 10, he had basically two options. He had hitter forward off his shoulder or out the back to Sexton, and it meant that Aki and Doris and Conan were running at Adams instead of running at Tompkins in the Welsh back row, who would have tackled him far easier.
Who, to be fair, I thought most of the Welsh back row actually played fairly well.
I think they're very good. They're good players. But I mean, Tame Basham, who I mentioned last week, I think, he is brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm really impressed with Tame Basham. Wainwright as well. He's decent, and they are, you know, but they're relatively lightweight, aren't they?
Yeah. They're in the Scotland back row mold more than the Ireland back row mold. They're relatively lightweight. They're there to be mobile and around the pitch, which they did a decent job of. But I mean, I agree. I think Wainwright did a good job, but you stick a fit Faletau there. Mm. It's a bit of a different ball game. You take Adams out and you stick a fit Jonathan Davis there. It's a bit of a different ball game. And I think Wales's problems all stem from the fact that they're missing a generation of players almost. Like there are the Eliases and the Wainwrights and the Bashams in some positions, but who've they had come through in the centres?
Mm. We mentioned that the other week when they had, was it in the autumn where they had the centres were just, they had Owen Williams and Johnny McNichol, and you got Watkin, you've got Lloyd.
They've stolen Tompkins from England and they've stolen Halaholo from somewhere else. That's not saying that they shouldn't be playing for Wales, but the point is that the Welsh conveyor belt of centres just isn't there. They're not coming through the junior setups.
No, they're not. But I mean, obviously, Davis and Halaholo were unavailable this weekend because why would you pick one of the world's, and I'm going to say this, currently one of the world's best wingers and finishers in Josh Adams and pick him at 13. Why would you think that's a good idea?
And they tried it with North as well. So this isn't a new problem with centres, but it's bonkers. But yeah, and if you look at other key positions, I think they're going to be in the same position in a few years' time. Like Liam Williams and Halfpenny, who's filling that gap when they're not there? I'm not sure they've got the quality of people coming through at fullback. Same in the second row. Do they have the quality coming through? I'm not sure they do. And I suppose, the future for 5 years' time is not looking massively rosy for Wales.
No, and I did think that it was noticeable, and I know I've given him a fairly hard time over the years, just how much of a galvanising effect Alan Wynn has for Wales, just from a leadership perspective, because they didn't know whether they were coming or going on Saturday.
Yeah, and on Phil's point, they took a bit of a pasting in the under-20s as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think they'll be better next week.
Still, it's fine, though, because we're going to go, England's going to follow the ring-fenced route that they have, and we'll be in the same situation in 10 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't bode well, does it? Okay, well, let's move on there. I mean, obviously, Ireland go to France on Saturday evening, which is going to be a brilliant game, isn't it? I mean, we'll talk about France briefly in a minute. But, you know, it's certainly a mouth-watering contest, those two going at each other in Paris, and having watched France just today afternoon, whilst they struggled a little bit, early doors to get a bit of rhythm to get going. I mean, should we just cover that game off now quickly before getting into Scotland, England? It's probably wise. Yeah. I was impressed with Italy for half an hour. Stuck to their task. They did all right.
They did all right. They're the same as they've been for years, though. They stay competitive because they're still international rugby players at the end of the day. They should at least be, matching teams for work rate and sort of kind of basic skills at times. But they kind of, they lack a bit of penetration in attack. You know, they don't have as many big ball carriers as other teams, and they don't have quite as much magic in the backs, although they, you know, they do have some youngsters coming through, and hopefully they, you know, they're going to slowly get better in that sort of respect. But they just shoot themselves in the foot.
They make some shit decisions, don't they?
You know, there was, they had a chance with a penalty and missed the line out, and they had a chance. They won a turnover on their own line. All they had to do was kick the penalty away, and the fly half.
Oh, he taps it.
Tapped, ran, kicked it away, and then the French came back at them. And you know, the try that they conceded when they were ahead was a shocker.
The interception.
Yeah. I mean, great play by the French flanker. You know, that took a bit of holding on to that.
Gelosh.
Yeah. But you know, it just gets a little frustrating, because I think everyone wants Italy to do well. And Lloyd, you know, our friend in our correspondent in Bucharest, he watched the Georgia game.
Yeah, Georgia Portugal, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he said Italy would have absolutely smashed them. So you know, that debate's perhaps been put to bed for a little while. But it's just, you know, it's a little frustrating to watch, because you could, like you said, they're almost there at times. You know, they put 5 minutes together and then just give away a daft penalty, or you know, miss an easy line out, or just something goes wrong, or they lose patience. And in terms of France, you know, yeah,
it's a lovely little run out for France, that first game, isn't it? A lovely little bed into the tournament, home to Italy. You're almost guaranteed 5 points. Yeah, you might be rusty to start off with, which they were, the French. It took them a little while to get going. But once they find their stride, you know.
Once Penno got moving, he was impressive, wasn't he?
He is very good. I mean, across that back line, I was impressed with Dante. I quite enjoyed, thought he was good. In the hard ball carrying 12 role, which released Fiku to do a little bit more on the outside. Then you've got Villiers, who I thought was a bit of a revelation in the autumn. He's had a bit of a meteoric rise, isn't he? He was playing in French Pro 2 not so long ago, and now he's scoring hat-tricks for France. I mean,
yeah,
he looks very, very good. Having Jaminet at fullback, having the ability of him at fullback to then, you know, cover the whole backfield against an Italian side who didn't really offer too much kicking, and then Untermack as well, and we didn't really even need to talk too much about Dupont, because he didn't do very much really. It wasn't a virtuoso performance from Dupont, but he didn't have to because France are now less France are less reliant on Dupont's magic and wizardry, because they cover all bases so well. I mean, you talk about the Irish back row of Doris van der Fleer and Conan. Mate, Aldrete, Gelonche and Craw were unbelievable. Aldrete is unreal. He is like...
Yeah, he's almost undersized, isn't he?
Yeah,
but he's
yeah.
just constant. And And he's like a bag of spanners, isn't he? He just, just all like angles and so, you know, he's just constantly carrying. And their second row has always been quite underwhelming for quite a long time. You know,
I'd always thought the French second row was cumbersome.
Yeah. And now you've got Woki, and it's just different gravy, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's so dynamic.
It's a word that we've used so many times, or I feel like I use about 30 times in every podcast when we talk about internationals. It's balance. They've never had that balance in the second row. They've always had two big lumps of second rows. Now they've got, Willems is like as good a big lump as there is out there.
Yeah.
But then you balance that off with Woki, who is, as much as I hate to say it, one of those players a bit like Laws, who has a lot of flanker about them, but can play very well in the second row.
He's the French Maratoge, isn't he? Without making that direct comparison too much, they play in a very similar way. They were both on the edge. They're very athletic. They're very dynamic. They're both irritating. Like they look like irritants, you know, like they get under the skin of opposition.
And in the
that's,
line,
that's the comparison. He's so athletic and dynamic. Yeah. You know, perhaps like you say, he needs a lump with him, but they've got enough lumps to, they could probably pick 15 lumps from that French league. So, I think,
I think it would be a bit disrespectful to just call Wilhelms a lump. Because he is a lot more than that.
Yeah, fair. But he needs someone of that size.
He's no Charlie Yules. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, good. Good from you, that. Okay. Well, as I say, it was easy for France. It was easy for France in the end.
The frustrating thing with Italy is you hear it every year that they're building something that's really great and really positive, and it's just going to take time to come through. We've been waiting for it for 15 years. And it doesn't come through. And the under-20s, they don't look particularly... I mean, they beat Scotland last year in the under-20s, but then Scotland got humped by everybody. And they don't rely on under-20s to get their players.
I think they've had some good results in the World Cups, though, haven't they, I think? So, yeah, that is...
I don't know. It's maybe it's too big a gap for them to close at the moment. Maybe they are moving forwards, but... the rest of the Six Nations as a group are just keeping far enough away from them. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different, completely different era, and you can't compare it too much, but they're doing a lot better than France did when France first came in, you know, at this stage, you know, so it is a big step. I mean, to be fair, the winger that was a tremendous finish. And that he's the youngest try scorer in the championship for a very long time. So credit when credit's due, really. And
Menicello, that wasn't it?
Very nice in a cocktail.
Or on a warm summer's day.
To put it into context, 20 years after France joined the championship, they played 4 and 1-2, lost 2. And Italy have been in the Six Nations for 22 years.
And not long after that, they were competing as Germany for a few years. So
they're not quite at France's standards yet.
No. Let's get off of Italy. I'm going to say we'll look forward to France versus Ireland at the weekend, but Italy, who are England's opponents, who will hope to bounce back from a disappointing defeat. I mean, how was life in your household on Saturday evening, Phil?
Fine. Mrs. Farnbett has given up caring about rugby through years of Scotland being crap, so now they're less crap. I don't need to get ribbed about it. But yeah, the father-in-law did ask whether I'd watched the rugby and I chose to ignore him.
It's probably for the best. I mean, where do we start with England? There's so many things that we can unpick. There's so many things we can talk about. Why don't we start with selection? I mean, we spoke about it a bit last week about who we thought he was going to pick. Nobody picked that they thought was going to pick Elliot Daly at 13, which you could argue is his best position. So,
or Sam Simmons at 8.
Or Sam Simmons at 8. Or Marchant on the wing with Daly at 13. There was all sorts of strange stuff. Now, we mentioned a minute ago about Wales picking Josh Adams at 13. One of the best wingers in the world. Certainly one of the best finishers in world rugby at the moment, Josh Adams, who scores tries for fun. Eddie Jones seems to have this fascination of square pegs and round holes, or maybe not square pegs, but pegs and round holes, but players who have an all-round ability to do a lot of different things. So if you looked at England's backline at Saturday, you had Youngs and Smith, who were playing legitimately in their position. Then you've got one of the best 13s that we've had playing at 12. We've got a guy that's played the majority of his international career on the wing and at fullback at 13. We've got a guy who's played all of his club career pretty much at 13 on the wing. There's another guy who plays 10 or who, you know, is the ultimate utility back almost on the other wing. And then you've got a legitimate fullback. Is that ever going to be a recipe for success?
No. Yes. No. Yeah, if you're playing Malta. but no, not against a legitimate opposition. Dougie shot me down when I said this, and I feel totally vindicated in saying that Marcus Smith needed a hard ball carrier outside him because he missed that option. There wasn't that option. Be that Dombrandt playing at eight, giving him an option not off first phase, or be that Tuilagi, Atkinson, even Marchant as a harder ball carrying option, and Ollie Lawrence. I don't really care who it is. When you've got, I can't remember, I think it was Dunk who said it on the Twitter group chat, that entire back line was a back line full of kickers and footballers. So that's all you're ever going to get is footballers. There's no intrigue or disguise. And saw it in the first 20 minutes. England didn't kick the ball anywhere near as much as you expected them to. But all they did was they passed the ball out wide. And it's so easy to defend against.
Well, what's the first thing
there's
you
no know? Other viable options. You've got to earn the right to go wide, and they didn't do it. They just
when they actually managed to work Simmons or Ludlam into the midfield, they actually got a bit of change out of it. But because of the Scottish back row being a bunch of menaces, they didn't do it enough. And the lack of a straight line guy was absolutely noticeable, and I was 100% with you the other week as well, Phil. You know, I think we may have, like, when me and Russ just started gibbering to each other at the end last week, we might have hit on something, and that we had in English rugby these centres for probably 10 years from when Will Greenwood retired that were just brick walls that ran in a straight line and tackled. And I think coaches probably from quite a young level were trying not to produce just that kind of centre.
Jamie Noon.
Yeah. So someone that could play with ball skills, they didn't just say, all right, fly half or fullback. They were like, right, we'll make a 12 at you. And I think as the years have gone on now, all our centres are getting smaller and more interchangeable as a 12, 13 or 10. I mean, we've got, And I think the big lads were put at six or on the winger. Like now you've got huge wingers everywhere, and I think it's perhaps gone a little bit too far. In that, you know, if you went around the Premiership now, there's very few big centres. You've got Atkinson and Tuilagi that are English qualified, and then you've got your Esterhuizens.
And Devoto's a hard ball carrying centre. He's not a ball playing centre. I reckon every team would have somebody who would fit that mould, albeit they might not be top class. They would offer an opportunity. I mean, Ollie Lawrence was there not that long ago. When have you ever looked at a game where Brad Barrett's played, or Tuilagi, or Jamie Roberts, or D'Alende, and gone, or Manonu, and gone, oh Christ, they would have been much better with Elliot Daly playing in their position instead. It just doesn't happen because they offer something. You might go, oh, they'd look quite good with Elliot Daly. And I wouldn't, because I don't think he's anywhere near as good as people think he is. But nobody would ever look at it and go, what we need is another ball player in there when we've got the best in the Premiership, who we've stopped allowing him to play ball because he's going to play formulaic. And we've got a world-class 13. And you're right, Russ. You've got Max Malins, who's a ball player as well, out on the wing. Like, what we didn't need is another ball player.
We touched on it with Ringrose. Ringrose is a 13. He's a 13 to his fingertips. And he played like a 13. Aki is a 12 to his fingertips and he played like a 12. But we had three, four probably what you could call 12 and a halves or 13 and a halves. And they all just were a little bit confused, like singing off different song sheets. And if you look at how difficult Ireland made life for Josh Adams, who very rarely plays 13, and how relatively easy England made life for Chris Harris, who plays 13 all the time and defends that channel as well as anyone, they just needed someone to fix it, to just bash some holes. And I don't want to be that guy, but Tuilagi came on and absolutely smashed Esther Hazen two or three more big hits.
The positive thing is, the fact that we're playing Italy this weekend, I think, gives Tuilagi another 2 weeks out of the squad. Yeah.
Leave him out of the squad for this week,
and then bring him back in for the game in 2 weeks' time.
And on the Wednesday before the game, he'll pull his hamstring.
I'm
not one of these sort of, you know, people that are sat at Twickenham going, Tuilagi, he's the best player in the world. But they just need someone who can do what he does. And in the Premiership, he's the one that does it the best. So you might as well pick him.
Given that he wasn't fit enough to play that game, you pick Atkinson there because he's the best at that kind of role who's available. There's never been a top quality international side that hasn't had a hard running centre. Now, they might be playing at 13 and not 12, but there's never been a side that's dominated in the way that the player pool says that England should be dominating against the Scotland player pool without a hard running 12. And you compound that even worse by having Sam Simmons, who's an amazing 8, but he's not a big hard ball carrying 8, and having Don Brandt sat on the bench.
I thought Simmons actually played really well.
I'm not criticizing him. I'm just saying that.
But he wasn't the balance of
the team. It's all wrong.
Yeah, he wasn't as impactful as maybe he could have been. Or sorry, I don't think he was impactful as maybe Don Brandt would have been from the start for that very reason, Phil.
Yeah,
and he probably would have been more impactful off the bench.
My view on Simmons, and he was far better in this game than probably his other England starts. I think he's a player that can win you the game, but he's perhaps not a player that can dominate a game.
Yeah,
I think he fades out for, you know, 5-10 minutes sometimes. And even for Exeter, you could forget he's playing and then he'll pop up and score a try.
He pops up in the right places at the right time.
Yeah, which is a great skill to have. But like, if you think about against New Zealand in the World Cup, Curry and Underhill between them dominated that game.
I
saw an Exeter game. I was at an Exeter game and he had a head bandage on for some reason. And because he had a head bandage on, you start noticing him a bit more. And I think he probably does a lot more work than he necessarily gets credit for. But you don't spot it necessarily.
I don't doubt it, Phil, because he's a brilliant player. And I think if you had decided to turn him into a 7, you'd have made a 7 out of him easily.
Yeah.
But I think some other players are more involved more effectively more often.
But given that you know that Courtney Laws is gone, who is a massive physical presence, he's out of the team. You're not having a physical presence in the centres. Having him playing, just the whole balance is just completely wrong.
I don't know whether I agree with that. Because I thought Ludlam offered a large amount of physicality.
I thought Ludlam was great.
Yeah.
I
think psychologically, maybe that's a factor. But in actual, I think that Ben is right. Where Simmons will go and he will get the ball more towards the midfield. They will try and look for Simmons to get pockets in the midfield. Whereas sometimes we didn't have any. Or England didn't have any of those close contact ball carriers who can punch you those 2 or 3 lines, those 2 or 3 yards near the contact area to then enable you to get that front foot ball to hit it in the midfield. England were trying to hit that front foot ball in the midfield without having front foot ball.
Simmons runs at gaps or around front row players. He doesn't run at people and over people.
Yeah.
And that's what we missed, is somebody to run at people.
Yeah. Yeah. You need someone who's going to do it. I mean, so for all of the selection debates, for all of the, you know, I say shortcomings that England had in regards to physicality, we have to praise the way that Scotland played. Now, without sounding too harsh, England made it very easy for Scotland to play the way they played, especially defensively, as in when Scotland were defending. But in attack, England also made it very easy for Scotland. I mean, the first try for White was some of the poorest defence I've seen from an England team in a long time. Missed tackles, big gaps, no tracking. And it seemed to take England a little bit by surprise, which it really shouldn't have done when they've got the likes of Hogg and Darcy Graham, who is a very good player, by the way. I think I always used to think he was a bit small. He looked like he's put a bit of size on. And his running lines all day were brilliant. And having what the one thing I thought they did do well is in tight situations, Van der Merwe came looking for work and almost turned himself into their straight running. Because Sam Johnson's not a big ball carrying 12. They utilised Van der Merwe sometimes back on the inside in those tight situations.
I thought he was really good.
He was really good.
Yeah. I think Phil might disagree a little bit, but I thought it was almost like a team that, you know, a football team that soaks up a lot of pressure and then just hits on the break. Because England were, they must have had the ball for 20 minutes. Pretty much before Scotland scored. Scotland got the ball, scored with almost their first attack. And it was almost like, you know, when you see it on the telly and it's like, oh, the goalkeeper's picked the ball out of the net with his first touch, you know?
Yeah.
I think as well, I mean, yeah, they missed tackles. And I thought Ezekwe had a rough day. I didn't blame Marchant too much. He was sort of,
well, Marchant was dry there for a rock and a hard place. Yeah. There's not a lot he could do there.
But, you know, that was a great finish. Their other try came off two great kicks, and there was a real good carry by Van der Merwe between the two kicks. And I bet, well, we're probably going to debate that in a minute.
there's nothing to debate, is there?
Yeah,
no. I on the day, I thought the penalty try was harsh, but actually now having seen what the actual law is, I mean, it's to me, it was, yeah, yellow card.
So what is the actual try. Law?
Once the penalty's committed, it's that player is then non-existent, isn't he?
So you've got a guarantee. So what you've got to bear in mind is you've got a guarantee that Graham is going to catch that ball from that cross kick.
Well, probably, isn't it? Is he probably going to catch it? Yes,
A penalty try is awarded between the goalposts if foul play by the opposing team prevents a probable try from being scored or scored in a more advantageous position. So, but what's the alternative? If he doesn't bat the ball into touch, if Luke Cowan-Dickie doesn't bat the ball into touch, the alternative is he catches it or Graham catches it and he tackles him.
Yeah, but I think what you have to take into account is once he's committed foul play or a penalty offence, it wasn't foul play, it was a penalty offence.
If it's not foul play, it can't be a penalty try. So it is foul play.
All right, well, it's foul play, but it's not, when we say foul play, we're usually talking about punching someone in the face or something like that. But I think you have to take him completely out of the account. So if Cowan-Dickie isn't there, then
It's likely this. Yeah.
It's total semantics, really.
Cowan Dickey would have been better off
trying to catch the ball
and giving the ball to Darcy and just letting him score.
He'd have been better off not trying to catch it and just making a tackle.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Letting it hit his head. He'd been better off doing absolutely anything. But
I don't think he needs to apologise. I mean, it was just heat of the moment, completely out of position. And he just got his jump wrong, knew he wasn't going to catch it, and just kind of had a brain melt. But, you know, can't argue with the decision. I did at the time quite vociferously, but now I think about it.
So Matt Williams, the former Scotland coach, said that it shouldn't have been a penalty try, but he's not a referee, he's a coach, and I don't really care what they say. It largely doesn't matter because England didn't deserve to win that game.
Absolute facts.
Do you know what the thing that got me most, though, was? It wasn't that. It was the penalty that came next. Because whoever it was, I'm assuming it was Eddie Jones, decided he'd be clever and leave Marler to throw in for
the
line-out.
What a fucking bullshit decision. The first thing you need to do is get the hooker on. And as soon as there is a line-out, like I get not putting a hooker on pre-line-out.
Because you know for a fact that Cowan Dickey's not coming back on the pitch.
Yeah, that's right. So why not then? As soon as that line-out goes... You make the substitution. You have Jamie George ready. So as soon as that ball goes into touch and you've got a line out, he's coming on. So Jamie, you're not coming on just yet. But if there is a line out, you are on straight away. That's just what happens.
You could slow down the game.
And you could slow down the game because what they actually did with Marler making that whatever that was. Only resolved to speeding the game up at a point where England really needed to just slow it down.
Yeah, and for all the things we've said about Marler, I felt sorry for him in that situation.
I'm not going that far.
No. can I come back to what you said earlier, Ben? Because you're right, I do disagree with you. There's been comments about how Scotland were clinical in attack. And they really weren't. Whenever they got the ball in the first half, they basically gave it away. I don't mean that they knocked on or whatever. I mean, their attack ran out of steam and they kicked the ball away. They only managed to score a try because England missed four tackles. And I'm not putting Marchant completely off the hook. I think they would have scored anyway, but I think his attempt was relatively poor there. And then in the second half, they were running us ragged for that second try. But the reality is, if Cowan Dickey, not 99 times out of 100, he doesn't have a brain fart there. He either catches the ball or he waits for Graham to catch it and then he tackles them. They don't score a try. So we gifted them two tries.
At worst, you're giving away. If he tried to catch it and caught it, probably the worst happens is he's given away a penalty for holding on.
Or he gets dragged into touch or something like that. So we've gifted them the vast majority of their points. And other than that, I agree with what you're saying about Van der Merwe. I agree with what you're saying about Graham. 100% they defended what was in front of them perfectly. What was put in front of them to defend was pretty weak. But I just don't think that they were that impressive. I just think it was more a case that England were.
Yeah. And I think a better team, a more organised team put Scotland away on Saturday easily.
I mean, quite honestly, I think if you'd have said to me before the game, it's Scotland are going to win by 3 points, I would probably have said, that makes sense. You know, I don't think that's the greatest England team that's ever taken the pitch. England had that game won, though, I think.
They did.
I think substituting Smith, and you know I'm a big fan of George Ford, but I think substituting Smith just gave such a momentum switch because England had just got on top. Smith was starting to grow into the game more and more, but he's he's got an aura about him now that he's going to pull something out of the bag. Yeah. And just by taking him off, it wasn't the fact that Ford came on and played badly. It was just you've taken the form player off, and the piece of play that I think showed that was when England kicked into the corner, and Hogg took an absurd risk to keep the ball on, and he could easily have conceded a try from that, or at least a 5 meter scrum. And I'm not quite sure what Malins was trying to do. He kind of slid past him, and let him get up. And I just think, you know, that showed that Scotland were just sort of teetering on the edge there. And then that might have been just after Smith went off or not. I can't quite remember, but it was at that point. And I think they got a sort of psychological boost, and it was almost like as well a sort of declaration we are, you know, we're happy with what we've got now. We're going to sit on the back foot and defend. And it really didn't work out at all.
I think the overarching thing for me isn't anything about any of the players that were picked or how they played. To me, the overarching thought and feeling is just that Eddie Jones is tactically inept. How he's got to the position he's got with the player pool he's got available and the quality and skill set that's there, how he keeps making cock up after cock up after cock up. And we have these same conversations about how he's made tactical mistakes all along. The only thing he's good at is convincing the RFU to keep paying him. He is the Boris Johnson of the rugby world.
I think every mistake he makes is also to do with him trying to be too clever.
Yes, I agree. Like England looks so disorganized in the back division because, in my opinion, none of them had clearly defined roles because they were all trying to do a little bit of everything. Whereas when you have a Tuilagi or you have a game plan, you know, we criticised England a lot for the kicking game plan two autumns ago, or, you know, autumn.
We didn't.
Well, I did.
Yeah.
But at least it was.
They were winning, though, weren't they?
They were, but at least it was a game. It was a game plan. It was visible. It was a visible game plan. And if a game plan doesn't work, then you've got to look to change it in any given situation. What I didn't see on Saturday was any sort of formula or formulaic game plan that they were looking to structure to work to.
I think it was shift it wide and then go for a tactical kick, which is a bit of a hybrid of two bad game plans. But either way, I just don't think he's never adaptable. Never have we had a game where England have played as abjectly as they did for bits of that first half, and then they've come out in the second half and played better. They controlled the ball. They just had zero penetration with it at all. And then in the second half, nothing changed for the positive. And that's typical Eddie Jones, is they go in at halftime with some challenges and they come out with more challenges.
And I know Stuart, like, pop, you know, he's quite often on the wing to deal with box kicks and stuff like that. But who are your two backs who are, you would probably say, aren't going to be changed? Is your fly half, who is an all-out fly half, and your fullback, who's an all-out fullback. Whereas everyone else, you could say, well, Slade could be playing 12 or 13 next week. Marchant could be playing 13 or 14. Malins could be playing any of the positions across the back line. And at the risk of belaboring the subject, I think that's the problem.
Yeah. I mean, like having Quirk and Randall and Noel on the bench and basically not using them at all, I think is pretty deplorable. I think you've got a player in Malins who was almost born to wear the 23 shirt, I think, as a utility back. he is the ultimate player to do that at the moment. A bit like I think Elliot Daly was for a period of time.
Malin's overall had a decent game.
Yeah, but he shouldn't be starting on the wing for England. There are better actual wingers to start on the wing for England, the same as there are better actual centres than playing people out of position in the centre or playing centres out of position in the centres, if that makes sense. As we've already alluded to, we've sort of come full circle now.
I think we should probably,
as we head to Italy,
finish off Ben Youngs. He's been playing a lot better these last couple of seasons. I still think his speed of delivery is slow. Yeah. I don't think he made a difference significantly either way. I do think if Harry Randall would have come on with 20 minutes to go, he might have made a difference.
I struggle to see where Ben Youngs fits in to the next World Cup. So with that in mind, why aren't we playing Quirk and Randall now all the time?
In the commentary box, that's where he fits in.
Yeah, whatever. He can go wherever he wants. I mean, people will argue, oh yeah, he's still got plenty to offer. He's offered a lot and he's given a lot. Fair play to him. He's had a decent career. But we need to move on. We moved on with Marcus Smith. That took a bit of time, probably too long. We need to move on. And that is Quirk. It is Randall. It is whoever else is out there.
Van Portfleet,
yeah, whatever. Moving forward to Italy this weekend, do you see him making many, if any, changes? I know Courtney Laws is hopeful he'll be back fit. Is it worth making wholesale changes, or do we bring people in to take to Italy that are fringe, and we go, you know, and we try things, or do we actually just need to get back in the wagon and get a victory?
I'd like to see Launchbury involved because I think he does add. He would have added. I think he'll probably start with Dom Brandt, and he has to change the midfield. Whether he will or not is up to him. But for me, he absolutely has to change that midfield.
I'd be willing to bet he makes no changes unless Laws is back fit. But just because he's bloody minded. What would I do? I mean, I'd put Atkinson in. I think I'd let Tuilagi play two more club games. I don't know what's more beneficial for him to spend a week with England and then go back to his club and play a week or play two club games. I think I'd put Atkinson and Slade. I'd play one of the wingers.
Noel on the wing instead of Marchant.
You play one of the wingers on the wing?
Well, yeah, I'd play a winger on the wing, I think. I think about Pascal Collins or Radwan, yeah. I think, just to give him a run, you know, just to... I think he's got to eventually pick... I mean, yeah, he hasn't... I mean, look at it. He hasn't picked a winger. He hasn't got a winger. He's got Malins and Marchant. Neither of them are wingers. So play a winger.
Radwan scored a great try at the weekend for Newcastle as well. Fantastic.
I'd like to see Pascal Collins or Radwan get a game in Italy. Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to see Jack Noel play. I think Jack Noel offers a real point of difference as a winger, but also somebody who can do something different. But he is a winger.
I think if Noel had come on in that game, he would have at least have, like you say, been a bit different and maybe tried something that might have made a difference. I think, if Laws is fit, I think, you know, he will play him. It'd be interesting to see if he plays him in the row or in the back row though, because, you know, as I say, Ezekiel didn't have the best of games. The back row all did okay.
Think he could leave the back row and have, especially against Italy, he could put Laws back in the second row.
I mean, I wouldn't mind Dom Brandt at six with Simmons and Curry. I could see that working okay. Because, you know, a scrum in your own 22, you could put Dom Brandt at eight, and then, you know, middle of the field, give Simmons pick up and run there, maybe have Dom Brandt at eight in a defensive scrum, maybe, you know, you don't have to keep them in their same positions. I don't know what that was.
No, nor do I.
I just I don't think he'll make a lot of changes.
If you're going to look at Laws as a six, which I'm fairly laid back about, Launchbury's had two games back and has played really well. And I just think he's reliable enough that you could drop him in there to free up Laws to go to the back row.
Yeah, I mean, Launchbury is better than Johnny Hill, I think. And so
when he's fit, yeah.
Yeah. So if someone's an injury replacement for Johnny Hill, I think if you've got Launchbury firing all cylinders, bring him in. But it's the same argument as Tuilagi, is he? What's better for him if you want him to play against Wales, then what is the better option? Go to Italy or play with your club, you know?
Yeah, he played 40 minutes against Saracens and played 60 minutes against Chiefs. So, yeah, it is. I think if it was France, I wouldn't be saying that, but it is Italy.
And it might be, it could be an opportunity to get him back into the international fold, 60 minutes, you know, or even off the bench to work him back into it. But yeah, you're right.
Can he make changes? Can he make changes from the original squad?
I think he can do what he wants, can he?
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, he usually does. So,
yeah.
I wouldn't put it past him. We did have a couple of other comments on the Twitter, which was, Hamish Watson has made 163 tackles in a row. I know there was a stat about Johnny Hill a few years ago that made a load of tackles. But for Hamish Watson as a seven, making 163 tackles without missing one's pretty impressive.
He's an absolute machine.
He's amazing.
And yeah, that's why you need somebody big running at him, so they'll keep him on the ground for a little bit longer.
Yeah, and the other thing that Nick Johnson mentioned was, did England suffer from having an inexperienced captain? Do you think that makes any difference? Tom Curry being a captain.
I think they suffer. I think they potentially, but I think they suffered more from not having a game plan.
They're right players.
Yeah. They suffer more from selection. Yeah.
I will say though, like I mentioned about Alan Wynn's leadership experience in that Wales side. When you looked at that England team, there wasn't, I mean, even with Owen Farrell in it, as much as people have their gripes about Farrell, you know who's leading that team. I did think,
Farrell's played enough of those kind of games where we've ended up losing them that makes me think.
It's not. It was more of a wider point than specifically at Curry. I'm not having a go at Tom Curry. I don't think there's any reason to. But I just thought in general, I mean, even with Courtney Laws in the autumn, you kind of knew who was dragging that team along, and yeah, I don't know. Just maybe a little lack of leadership. Are the people in that leadership group stepping up? That's the only question.
Don't know.
And then I'll cough and mute myself. All right. Well, let's move on. There was a full round of Premiership fixtures this week. Didn't see too much of it, unfortunately. But Wasps beat Exeter at Sandy Park. Last minute try by Paolo Odogwu. Which has really hit the Chiefs. Chiefs slipped down to seventh. Wasps leapfrogged them.
I think they are down to their bare bones in the pack, Chiefs are. They're down to kind of eighth, ninth choice second rows. Hannes Kirsten starting at second row, who is an out-and-out flanker. I think actually, I put it on the group. When I saw the team sheets, I'd have been quite happy if you'd have offered 2 points for that game. Because Wasps had pretty much their first choice team out. And Chiefs, as I say, backs looked pretty strong. But in the pack, they were down to the bare bones.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, Rob Bass is never going to admit it. And they're never going to, Exeter are never going to get to a point where they're saying, oh, well, you know, top four doesn't really matter. But if ever there was going to be a period of time where they needed to regroup and reassess, and, you know, they've been in the top four, I mean, five, six, seven seasons in a row. Can't remember exactly how many it is, but there's a lot of seasons on the bounce in the playoffs. They've made four finals on the bounce, haven't they, I think? So, yeah. You know, it's there had to come to a period of time where they would miss out, and it looked legitimately looking like this season could be a time for them. But you know, there's a long way to go.
At least they haven't missed out because they've been systemically cheating and got relegated.
Oh, well, I mean, talking of that, Saracens beat Bath 40-3, which is hardly a surprise for your Bath team, Ben. Bristol beat Newcastle at home 37-21, and Leicester beat Worcester 36-16. Friday night, Gloucester beat London Irish. And then on Sunday, Sale beat Harlequins at Harlequins. And I watched a bit of this game, and Sale, for all of Sale's good stuff, Harlequins were pretty poor, I must admit. Like, lots of handling errors, lots of just needless penalties, a lot of error-strewn stuff from Harlequins. But Ben, you did mention the return of Manu. He swiftly sat down Esther Hazen on a crash ball, didn't he? That was pretty delicious.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't do much with ball in hand, but, you know, he just came on and I think enjoyed himself knocking people about. And I think there were three hits that the commentators really enjoyed. Yeah, we got to be careful of sort of making him the sort of be all and end all of it. But, you know, Esterhuizen's been flying all season, and he was flying backwards once he got hit. And yeah. I just think we need to sort of jazz the team up a little bit. And you know, on form, he's unbelievable. So, you know, and that team, not only is it crying out for him, but it's always worked so much better with him in it.
Yeah.
You know, for years the game plan was based on him, and you know, it didn't look like it was this week, but maybe that was just because he wasn't available.
Yeah, well, it didn't like it was based around anybody this week, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's it. There is more Premiership this weekend. As we mentioned, the Six Nations hits back on Saturday with Wales against Scotland, and then France versus Italy. France against Ireland. England go to Italy on Sunday. On the Premiership, there's two games on Friday, Bristol, London Irish, and Leicester versus Saints. On Saturday, we've got Chiefs, Gloucester, Sale, Worcester, Wasp, Bath.
Sorry.
And on Sunday, we've got Saracens versus Harlequins. Any other rugby stuff you guys want to talk about?
No. So yeah, I got reported to the Cornwall Rugby Football Union.
Okay.
For allowing one of my players allegedly to, well, got reported because one of my players, under nines, was allegedly punching one of the Launceston under nines.
Brilliant.
And one of my players was kicking them, and I did nothing about it. But the really interesting thing was their coach came up to me, and I'm sure this is 50% of it, the other 50% being because we reported their under 15s because one of our under 15s had bite marks on his inner thigh. But their coach came up to me and went, all five of the other players playing on the pitch say they saw that your player punch them. To which I replied, I find that quite difficult to believe, bearing in mind that the alleged punch happened behind my back and all five of the other players on the pitch were in front of me watching the ball that was going in the opposite direction. So he said, oh, are you saying my players are lying? And I went, no, you're saying your players are lying. I'm just saying what they said didn't happen. But yeah, so the CRFU, I think, have taken a fairly dim view of it and gone, it's fucking rugby, grow up.
Oh, sorry, they've taken a dim view of him rather than him.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, not of me, yeah. And then went down to Redruth. How did you find Redruth, Russ?
I wasn't there, mate, thankfully. I'm aware, well, it was wet.
It was wet, but they provided a ref for the under nines game, which I thought was impressive of them, a neutral ref.
Excellent.
But yeah, it was a lovely, really enjoyable day in the way that rugby should be. So Redruth, well done. Launceston, you can fuck off.
Fair enough. It's always impressive. Like under nines, like if they're having a bit of a scrap at under nines, brilliant. Go on with it.
Yeah.
What's your problem? As long as it wasn't 5-on-1.
No, their big guy had spent the whole time being an absolute shithouse and pushing our kids after the tackles and pushing their face into the mud. It may have been one of our players thought he'd had enough of it, or it may not. I don't know. I didn't see it. It was behind me.
Well, if it's behind you, mate, you haven't got eyes in the back of your head, have you? You can only give what you can see.
Indeed.
Excellent. Well done. Ben, any other business?
Nah.
Nah, okay, fair enough. Nah. Had enough. No any other business. Bill, any other non-rugby related business?
I've never got any. I usually remember it once Doug does his for a while, and I usually remember one.
Cracking one 3 weeks ago. I've just forgotten it now. So
yeah.
I can't remember. I had one to bring with me, and I've forgotten about what it is. It was a little moan or something, but I can't remember.
Oh yeah, I'll have a little moan. Went last weekend to a friend's 40th up in Bath, which was very nice. Her husband had spent a reasonable chunk of money on it. We're in the Abbey Hotel in Bath, around the back of the Abbey, funnily enough. But I went to go and buy a little round of drinks, bought Mrs. Farmvet a gin and tonic, one of her friends a gin and tonic. Thought I'd treat myself at 12 o'clock and got myself a little cheeky margarita. And it was £45.
Wow.
Exactly. So those are the only drinks I bought all night.
I mean, that margarita was just enough of that.
It wasn't. The margarita was
on the bar.
The margarita was cheaper than the gin and tonics.
Wow. Yeah.
I will say, for the rugby on Saturday, Bristol was absolutely packed. And it was good. It was hard to get a seat anywhere to watch it, or all the pubs were busy. So, and it was good to see things getting back to normal.
I lived in Bristol for years, as you know, and what Six Nations games were always just the highlight of the year, because so many, it's a rugby town anyway, and you've got so many Welsh people there. So there was always some opposition to England, no matter who they were playing, which always made the pubs more interesting. And it was just a great place to watch rugby, really.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I mean, bar the result, it was a good night. And my friend, oh, I ran like, you know, when you stay at a friend's house or somewhere unfamiliar, and I got up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet, bearing in mind that I've been drinking
You didn't piss in his water.
No, I didn't. No, I mean, I'll let you decide whether it's better or worse than that. I had to take him home and put him to bed at 9 o'clock. Because he literally couldn't stand up. So we carried him home, put him to bed. So I'm there at his house. It's like 9:30. I thought, well, I might as well go to bed as well then. Obviously, I've been drinking all day. I got up at like 2:30 for an old man wee. And I didn't quite know where I was. Because I had a few anyway. And I couldn't find the door handle to open the door. And somehow I'd managed to not only not find the door handle, but I've fallen over in the alcove bit where the door is, and between the alcove and the bed. And I've smashed my head on something and twisted my knee. So I'm laying on the bedroom floor. And because I've been drinking, I've obviously got a bit of a sweat on my forehead, and I've banged my head. And all I can think of is dark. And it is, oh my God, I'm bleeding out of my skull, but it's just sweat. So I finally managed to find my way to the toilet and found this tiny little cut on my forehead, but I had an egg on the front of my head from where I banged it. I still didn't know where it was, and there was blood all down his nice white wall where I'd obviously scraped my head all the way down it. So that was Saturday night.
And did you finally find somewhere to have a piss?
By the time I dragged myself back up and worked out what was going on, I switched the light on and then found the door handle, and then realised that I had cut my head and I've really hurt my knee, like to the point where it's still really sore today. So there you go. Don't drink, kids. It's not cool. Right, that'll do, shall it, for this week. We'll get back next week. Oh, I wanted to say well done to Douglas for his YouTube debut last week for the RAF versus China. I thought it was excellent. Keep your eye out for more stuff on that and make sure you're supporting all of that sort of stuff. There's going to be more to come, I'm quite sure. I know we can't make tonight. And other than that, we will see you all next Monday for more Mauling Over. Actually, while I remember, I wanted to say thank you to the Rugby Paper. I don't know if any of you did see this, but the Rugby Paper last Wednesday, they were going to launch a new podcast with Jeremy Guscott and a couple of other people. And you know what they were going to call it? Mauling It Over. The Rugby Paper podcast was going to be called Mauling It Over. And thank you to some of our listeners who jumped on straight away and pointed out to them and us that there was already an established award-winning podcast called Maul Over, and they decided to take the tweet down and change the name almost immediately. And not only that, the guy from the Rugby Paper rang me, he messaged me on Twitter, and he rang me to apologise and say the last thing that they wanted to do was to step on anyone's toes, and they didn't realise, and you know, it wasn't their intention. You know, especially for smaller independent podcasts, they weren't trying to shove us out of the market. So, you know, all's well that ends well, really. And they say it's not often not the severity of the mistake, but it's how you deal with it afterwards. And they were brilliant about it. So fair play to them.
Good for them. It was quite humorous when about an hour after it went up, there were 7 comments and they were all from listeners of this pod going, change your name from the rubbish
phone. From all of our 7 listeners.
I was going to say all of our listeners did comment.
But yeah, there you go. So we're still around. But we'll be back next week for more chat and hopefully some good games this weekend. So go well.
Podcast Network.